Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Vitor Gaspar's tie matched his report. He was proud of it. He showed me. He is, of course, not just a sharp dresser. He runs the Fiscal Affairs Department for the International Monetary Fund. On April 10th, the IMF released its Fiscal Monitor. That's a big purple book of observations and suggestions for what countries should do with their budgets. We're going to spend some time on Europe in this conversation because Europe is full of countries telling other countries what to do with their budgets. This is Alpha Chat, a project from the Financial Times and the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. I'm Brendan Greeley. I'm at the IMF and World Bank spring meetings in Washington, D.C. Ultimately, my conversation with Vitor Gaspar came down to debt. What is the right kind? How much of it is enough? And are we smarter about it than we used to be? He is deep in these conversations. I mentioned Olivier Blanchard. He said Olivier is a friend. I mentioned Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. He said he wrote the Portuguese introduction to their book. But we started with a single sentence pulled from his report. The quality of fiscal spending has deteriorated. That is, there is good spending and there is bad spending. Here's Vitor.
One of the examples is that public investment has been on a declining trend in advanced economies. One of the facts that we have been documented for a long time in fiscal monitors is that countries that have strong governance in terms of public finances, they are able to protect public investment. And by doing so, they improve the contribution that fiscal policy makes to sustainable growth.
So when you say public investment, are we talking about roads and bridges? How do we define that category, public investment?
So normally, I emphasize public investment in infrastructure that includes roads and bridges, but in today's world, it also includes investment in networks. But in a broader context, when we discuss, for example, the Sustainable Development Goals 2030, we speak about investing in people and infrastructure. Human capital is extremely important, and so what governments provide in areas as health and education is crucial as well.
So high-quality fiscal spending is on broadband networks, roads, train lines, secondary education, or primary education. What's poor-quality fiscal spending?
For example, poorly targeted subsidies, wasteful subsidies, for example, on energy, transfer payments that benefit the most favored extracts of the population, subsidies that reflect rent seeking, and much else.
So I want to make this distinction, and the reason that line jumped out at me is that we have a very unproductive conversation in the United States, and I would say the discussion in Germany is comparably unproductive, where we don't do a great job of distinguishing between productive spending, high-quality spending, and poor-quality spending. So how do you draw that distinction for countries like the United States, which end up spending a ton of money on subsidies for favored classes and no money on infrastructure, and countries like Germany, which in a different way ends up with a similar outcome, which is that they're so focused on primary surpluses that they don't spend on infrastructure? How do you change that conversation from one of we can't spend to one of you can spend, but you have to spend well?
Let me start with the German example. When you focus on Germany, you do see that in Germany there has been a great success in terms of rebalancing the budget and bringing the public debt to GDP ratio down quickly. So there has been a very strong emphasis on putting one's own fiscal house in order. But arguably, you could say, well, looking at the long-run prospects of the German economy, it's very important that Germany continues to be a very competitive economy and improves its growth prospects. And from that viewpoint, given in particular the incredibly low level of interest rates that now prevail in Germany, with the full yield curve up to 10 years below zero, you could say that there is very productive investment in infrastructure, roads, railways, but also in networks, and in particular information networks, to invest in the future growth and the future competitiveness of Germany. Taking a long-term view is, I believe, the way to frame that debate in Germany.
But this has led to a situation overall in Europe where there's been such a focus on minimizing primary deficits and even creating primary surpluses. That's where all the political energy in Europe has gone for the last, arguably, 10 years. That you have a situation where public investment all over the continent has plummeted, which is now having real foreign policy consequences. So I feel like it's not hard to draw a line between Italy welcoming China, you know, welcoming public investment from China, and the dominant understanding within the European Union, which is we have to create primary surpluses, even if it means not borrowing money cheaply and fixing roads.
You just made a very interesting set of remarks. On my side, let me just make two that I believe are fair. The first is that the trend in declining public investment is not particularly pronounced in Europe. We do have that as a common trend across advanced economies. The countries that have been able to organize their public accounts in such a way that they have been able to protect public investment and the policies in general that sustain long-run growth are just a few. They're the exception rather than the rule. So no particular trend in Europe. When you look at Italy, one aspect which is extremely interesting to me, at least, is that growth, sustainable long-run growth, is the most pressing challenge, making it inclusive as well. One fact that most people don't know is that if you look at the 10 years that you referred to, so the last 10 years, the accumulated primary surpluses in Italy and in Germany are remarkably similar, but the public debt path is not. In Germany, it sharply declined, and in Italy, it actually went up slightly. Why? Because real growth and nominal growth were much stronger in Germany.
Because the economy has more potential to grow, because there's better infrastructure to do that.
Because Germany is a much more competitive economy compared with Italy.
But I'm curious about this word competitive, because we talk about it a lot, and there are many things that create a competitive economy. Better education, better infrastructure, better processes. But often, when we say competitive, what it really comes down to is you need to figure out a way to get your workers to accept nominal pay cuts. You need to become more competitive. That means that workers need to be paid less. So again, how do we change that conversation? This word competitive, particularly in the European context, is not adequate because so many things go into creating competitive. And often what it ultimately means is because you cannot adjust your foreign exchange mechanism within the European Union, you have no choice but to find a way to get workers to accept nominal wage cuts, which famously workers don't do. I mean, am I right in thinking that competitive ultimately comes down to pay cuts?
No, I would not agree with that. I would frame it completely differently. And I hope that my memory serves me right. So I remember that some years ago, many years ago, I'm not a young man anymore, many years ago, Paul Krugman was arguing that this notion of competitiveness that was being debated at the time in Europe as well was not a well-articulated notion because companies could be competitive, but countries could not, because the country could always devalue the currency. And so competitiveness was not a meaningful macroeconomic concept. In that context, I did discuss the notion of competitiveness with a number of German economists, and in particular, the late Horst Siebert. And he saw competitiveness as the ability of a location to attract investment and to be an attractive place to produce. In today's knowledge economy, a economy that's going to be prosperous in the future will not be competing in terms of low wages. It will be competing in terms of knowledge and human capital. So the start of your remarks where you were emphasizing innovation, investment in education, the quality of infrastructure, facilities that are complementary with location would be much more in line with the Horst Siebert notion of competitiveness that I believe is the most useful if you think about the long run trend as it will affect a specific location.
But that then makes it difficult to look to a country like Italy and say, become more competitive over the long run. Find a way to become to create long-term growth, but also maintain a primary surplus. Those two things feel incompatible.
No, you have to have a long-run strategy. You really have to think hard about the long trends that will shape your economy. If you think about sustainable inclusive growth as having to be sustainable, sound public finances are one of the cornerstones of that stability.
Olivier Blanchard, former chief economist of the IMF.
And a very good friend.
And a very good economist, published this paper earlier this year where he basically said a perfectly understandable thing that ended up causing an uproar among economists, which is, I'm becoming more comfortable with the idea under some circumstances of higher sovereign debt loads. It was very cautiously worded. Is that also true more broadly of the IMF? If he leaves the IMF, has a big long think, says, okay, under the following circumstances, I think it's okay. We don't yet really know what the costs of high debt are. It doesn't seem to be in many circumstances crowding out private investment. Has that thinking happened inside the IMF as well?
So let me say three things, and I feel strongly about the three. The first, Olivier is making very visible the fact that interest rates are very low. And if we look at the comparison between interest rates and growth rates, we see that over history, across countries, and even in our forecasts, we expect for most countries, most of the time, for growth rates to be above interest rates. And that is something that requires some thinking, and it's one aspect that I did highlight in the presentation of the fiscal monitor. So that's point number one. Point number two is that, if my memory serves me right, the formulation that Olivier has in his presidential lecture to the American Economic Association is that costs of public debt may be lower than you think. And he presents a framework to do that. He does qualify his views. For example, he uses the case that we have been discussing, Italy, as a counterexample. And there's a Patterson policy note where he does discuss the case of Italy, where you get the concept.
Because borrowing costs have risen in Italy.
Because borrowing costs are volatile in Italy. And at the current moment, borrowing costs are relatively high in Italy. The third and last point is the conceptual innovation from the presidential address of Olivier Blanchard. He discusses what is the right measure of the opportunity cost of public debt and deficits. And he looks at the borrowing cost of the sovereign, but he also looks at the marginal return on private capital. And he shows in the model that both costs matter for how you think about how costly is the accumulation of public debt. And so there is the possibility under crowding out that the cost is actually quite substantially. The latest addition that we make as IMF is to stress that financing conditions are very changing, and one cannot take low interest rates for granted. And we have many examples of countries around the world that have succumbed to the temptation of high debt when financing conditions were very favorable, just to see that when times get hard, the financing is not there and they end up having to manage the crisis.
Should we draw a distinction between countries that can borrow in their own currency and countries that can't?
There are many factors that determine vulnerabilities. Countries that borrow in foreign currency are much more vulnerable than countries that do borrow in their own currency, yes.
It's been almost 10 years since the Carmen Reinhart, Ken Rogoff paper that said, you know, there's a certain level of, at a certain level of public debt, it becomes a drag on growth. We don't have to get into the particulars of that paper because there were also some things, there were some, there was an Excel error in the paper, but the broader conversation that started was, is there a level of debt to GDP at which you can say, look, beyond here, there be dragons. Like, we just don't know what's going to happen and you have to be careful. Are we any closer to knowing what's that level, or is the level of debt to GDP, when you have such a high level in Japan and increasing level in the United States without sort of visible consequences, is that measure meaningful anymore?
So look, it's really a pleasure that you asked me that question. You're not going to believe me, but I wrote the foreword to the Portuguese edition of Reinhard and Rogoff.
I do believe you.
And I read the book very carefully. And I think that we now emphasize much more that our view on public debt sustainability, fiscal policy is much more country specific. And so we don't go for rough and ready reference values like a debt threshold. That being said, it has never been contested that higher levels of public debt, as the economists like to say, all other things equal, make a country more vulnerable. They place a burden on growth performance of the country, and they also make the country less able to manage macroeconomic risks, be it a prolonged or severe economic downturn or a financial crisis.
I want to get to corruption because it's the focus of this report.
Curbing corruption.
Curbing. Yes. Yes. Not. Let's be clear that the International Monetary Fund does not promote corruption. When I read that section, I recognized a lot of things that we see in the United States. We don't tend to see the United States as a corrupt country. It's a place where there's rule of law, where you don't have kickbacks with local officials. But there were some things: decreased tax revenues, and higher healthcare costs, higher education costs, that felt very familiar to me. So I wonder, do we focus too much on developing countries when we think about corruption and not on countries where you can see these things, but they're all happening in the light of day?
So we do cover, in our bilateral surveillance, we cover all members of the IMF. And we believe that good governance is a challenge to all countries around the world. And it's a job that is never done. That is, in our nations, institutional building is a constant challenge, and we can never declare definite success. In the context of our new approach to good governance and curbing corruption, we have a systematic approach across the membership, and we also highlight the international aspects of the fight against corruption. And in that context, a number of advanced economies have actually volunteered to be examined for their compliance with standards for the international fight against corruption, all G7 countries and three others. And the aspects that we're looking on have to do with the OECD anti-bribery convention that makes it illegal for managers of a corporation to try to bribe foreign public servants. And there is also the very important issue of the exchange of information on international financial flows, making it difficult to hide, for example, the proceeds of corrupt activities abroad.
Why is it so hard to crack down on tax havens? It seems as if the problem is pretty straightforward. You have a small number of countries with not a lot of visible economic activity, but tremendous tax revenues, and we can list them. And yet you have an unwillingness among developed economies to get together and solve what seems like a very straightforward problem. Why is that problem so difficult to solve?
The way we look at issues of international taxation have to do, on the one hand, with the importance of exchanges of information, and the OECD has made a lot of progress on the exchange of information. And if you and I were having this conversation 5 years ago, we would have been unable to forecast how much the exchange of information has become systematic and automatic. And that's very important to fight international tax evasion.
So and you see progress already?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The progress is quite impressive. We also very much emphasize the importance of a fundamental rethink of international corporate tax and the issue of the use of a number of devices by multinational corporations to minimize that tax burden is one of the most salient aspects politically that makes this issue urgent.
These are things like taking your intellectual property and moving it to Ireland so that you can move your economic activity there, for example.
Right. If you have an intangible asset and you locate the return on the intangible asset to a jurisdiction that has very low or no taxation, you're managing your tax liability in that particular way. The managing director actually wrote a piece for Financial Times where she called for a fundamental rethink. She looked at two aspects. One is that the concept of permanent establishment that attributed economic activity based on physical presence is obsolete in the current digital world, and that the other principle that covers your example, which is the arm's length principle, that states that one should take transactions inside the multinational company as if they were conducted by independent parties in a market, doesn't apply to all these transactions that have to do with intangibles, where you actually don't observe market transactions anywhere.
Vitor Gaspar, obrigado.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alpha Chat is produced by Dan Richards at the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance and Amy Keene from the Financial Times. Please email us, alphachat@ft.com, for any reason at all. For my part, I am going to have a long, hard think about what we mean when we say the word competitive.